We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with you this state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover this morning, starting out with some initiatives that kicked in this week.
Yeah, this week, two of the initiatives that voters passed in November became law. Gay marriage became legal in Washington state, and recreational use of marijuana also became legal. And King County, on the very first day that gay marriage was legal, issued about 489 marriage licenses, the bulk of those to gay couples to get married. And there will be a lot of church bells ringing this Sunday for that reason. And also, folks were celebrating the new medical marijuana law, even though the police
and we do mean celebrating. Yes,
yes, even though the police and politicians were trying to tell people, look, you know, it's not really legal yet because you can't legally buy it, yada yada yada. But people know better.
And there was a story, however, in the Thursday New York Times about how the Obama administration is going to handle marijuana legalization in Colorado and Washington. And the bad news is letting the states and the will of the states voters have the day was not even being considered an option. Instead, the two options that the Obama administration seems most to be mulling over are either go after the users, which is to say all those people who are lighting up in Seattle Center on Thursday, versus go after the states when they issue regulations. By all appearances anyway, as is consistent with the DOJ's attack on medical marijuana dispensaries and users over the past couple of years, it looks very much as though the Obama administration is not prepared to let these two states and any other states that pass similar initiatives or laws actually have priority over their citizens' public health, even though the citizens have passed this and said these laws are ridiculous and need to go.
Yeah, and nationwide, a new poll from Quinnipiac University found that voters have reversed their position on gay marriage and on marijuana in the United States. Voters now support gay marriage, whereas 4 years ago they were 55% against. Now voters are just a little bit more in support of it. 48% now to 46% are for gay marriage. And for the legalization of marijuana, a pretty good majority of 51% versus 44% are now for the legalization of marijuana for recreational uses. So
And in both of those cases, there's a huge gap between younger and older voters.
Oh, yeah. Voters nationwide now support these two issues. And you'd think the federal government would be paying attention.
All right. Moving on. We just got over with the last election, and we already are looking at local mayor's race.
Yeah.
Starting to heat up.
Welcome back, my friend, to the elections that never end. Ed Murray this week joined Tim Burgess and Mayor Mike McGinn in announcing the intent to run for mayor in 2013 of the city of Seattle. Murray can't actually formally announce or doesn't want to formally announce until the end of the legislative session because by law, he and anybody else who's in Olympia cannot fundraise for such a campaign until the end of the session, he can't fundraise while the legislature is in session. But he's formed an exploratory committee. There are at least three other names that are being mentioned running for mayor in 2013, those being former Councilman Peter Steinbrook, current Councilman Bruce Harrell, and former King County executive and Obama administration figure Ron Sims. Of those, Steinbrook is probably the one who's hurt most by Murray jumping into the race, and it's particularly interesting because Murray, at least as of the moment, is the Senate majority leader in Olympia. Now it's expected that he will become a Senate minority leader within a few hours of getting his title when the legislature opens in January. That because a couple of Democrats are expected to defect to the Republican side in order to vote for the majority leader in the Senate,
which would give them about a one vote majority.
Yes, but nonetheless, Murray, in relatively short time in the state Senate in Olympia, has risen to a position of great power there. And it's interesting that he's willing to walk away from that in order to try and run for the city of Seattle mayorship in what should be a pretty crowded field. And bear in mind also for all those people who are writing off Mike McGinn's chances is that McGinn got through to the primary and then won against a not very good opponent in 2009, specifically because it was a very crowded primary and he had a dedicated base that others did not have. There are stronger candidates in the field so far. Certainly Burgess and Murray are both stronger in terms of their constituencies than anybody who ran in 2009. But you know, can't discount McGinn just yet.
Yeah.
All right. On to a legislative update.
Yeah, the Senate Republican caucus leader, Mark Schosler, Job just mentioned how the Senate is probably going to swing to the Republican, to Republican control come January. The Senate Republican caucus leader, who wants to eliminate wasteful government subsidies, actually gets quite a few of them himself, according to the Environmental Working Group. They did a little calculation. Publicola had brought this issue up initially, saying that his farm in Ritzville got over $100,000 in subsidies over the last 15, 16 years. The Environmental Working Group went back, actually figured out what businesses were registered under his name and looked at the subsidies they got from the federal government, and they found that he actually gets $2.15 million. He'd received $2.15 million over the last 16 years in subsidies from the federal government. So a little hypocrisy there from the leader of the of our state Senate Republican caucus.
This is, by the way, a very, very consistent Republican dynamic.
Yeah.
Is that they are not opposed to government benefits. What they are opposed to is other people's government benefits.
Or government benefits for the people who actually need them. Now, the House Democrats, we're looking at the, not the Senate now, but the House, the state House Democrats, according to Publicola, are going to be breaking up the House Ways and Means Committee. Now, the Ways and Means Committee usually drafts the budget for state government spending. They're going to going to turn it into two new committees. One is an Appropriations Committee, which will be focused on spending, in other words, writing the spending portions of the budget, and the Finance Committee, which will be focused on the revenue side, in other words, how the state is going to collect money.
You know, the ways and the means.
Yes, the ways and the means. It's now two separate committees, one on ways and one on means. Now, this may mean a new focus on closing tax loopholes and maybe reforming the state tax system, which is currently a mix of sales taxes, property taxes, business and operations taxes, and business and occupations taxes, and various fees. That's been a mess for the state, particularly during the downturn when people were not buying very much, so sales taxes plummeted. The value of land went down with the sink in the housing market, so property taxes were lower. And to make it up, they couldn't raise B&O taxes because businesses would scream. So to make it up,
well,
they raised a whole bunch of fees.
And also Tim Imons.
Yeah, and Tim Imons.
Limitations
requiring a two-thirds majority. And so they managed to raise various fees by saying, well, we're not increasing taxes, we're increasing fees, which are not the same thing. And, of course, people have been screaming about that. So I think this separating the one committee into two is going to mean that the folks sitting on the Finance Committee, that's the revenue side, are going to be looking at maybe reforming the state's tax system. And that can only be good news, I hope.
All right. On to national and developments in Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan, Michigan this week became the 24th state to pass right-to-work legislation. Essentially, the right-to-work legislation bans unions from automatically collecting union dues at unionized workplaces. Michigan, of course, is the home of the United Auto Workers, so this is very disturbing news. Now, the dynamic of this whole thing is interesting too. It was passed by the Republican controlled lame duck legislature and will be signed into law by Governor Rick Snyder, even though he had said during the first 2 years of his governorship that he was not going to put this on his agenda. He's a Republican governor. That he was not going to put this on his agenda. It was too divisive. He had other things he wanted to get done. And yet here he is saying, okay, yes, even though it's a lame duck legislature, yes, I will sign it into law.
And not just a lame duck legislature, but one where the Democrats are controlling one chamber as of January. This is their last shot to do it.
The Republicans, yeah.
Yes.
The Republicans have an 18-vote majority in the House. And come January, they'll only have an 8-vote majority with a number of Republicans who don't support this legislation. So this is their last chance to pass it. And of course, there were big protests in Lansing, the capital of Michigan, this week by union members. 17.5% of state workers are unionized, and the police turned out in force to break up the demonstration and pepper spray the demonstrators, because of course the police union is exempt from this new law.
Yeah, as was the case in Wisconsin. And that same lame duck legislature, by the way, also passed a number of anti-choice and various other war on lady parts type legislation at the same time.
It's disturbing.
All right. Our so-called fiscal cliff.
Yeah, this week we saw a lot in the news by economists debating the actual existence of the fiscal cliff, finally.
I keep telling you it's a gentle fiscal incline.
Yes. it's interesting, you know, because this was the week, really. I think they started talking about it because this was the week when it became obvious that the Republicans in Congress simply cannot negotiate a deal with Obama. They just are incapable of it. For various reasons that we've discussed on this show. But economists are saying, well, okay, we're going to assume that no law gets passed, no deal gets made. That means that the Bush-era tax cuts will expire and the automatic budget cuts will kick in. What will that actually do to the economy? And after they scratched their heads and started asking some serious questions that it should have been asking long ago, they're beginning to come up with this notion that, well, maybe this fiscal cliff doesn't really exist. that by letting the Bush era tax cuts in particular expire, gosh, you know, those tax cuts really weren't a tax cut for lower and middle income people. They were a tax cut for the rich. And so
if they didn't help the economy when they were made, they wouldn't hurt it that much when they're rescinded.
Yeah. So the impact of them expiring is not going to be all that big for most Americans, you know, and it's kind of funny that they allowed this whole doomsday talk of the fiscal cliff go on and on and on. And until now, when it's clear it's going to actually happen, now people are saying, well, dang, I guess this fiscal cliff really is not a big deal like we thought it would. And what I thought was interesting were some of the statistics. They looked at the impact on the stock market, and they realized that the impact on the stock market was going to be nil because most Americans hold stocks in non-taxable accounts. So in other words, 401ks, IRAs, pension funds and insurance companies, et cetera, hold, and foreign investors hold the bulk of stock. Of U.S. stock, and that they don't pay taxes when they buy and sell stock in a non-taxable account, and that foreign investors are not subject to U.S. taxes. So, and they realize that only 14.7% of American households have mutual funds in taxable accounts, and that most of those are wealthy people, and that they could probably stand to pay a little extra in taxes.
All right. Developments this week at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Supreme Court announced this week that they are going to hear two cases on gay marriage. One is they decided to pick up and hear the case on California's Proposition 8, which is the constitutional ban on gay marriage, overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled that the state can't take away a right that was initially granted to gay folks to get married. And then the second case that the Supreme Court will hear is the case on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in which an elderly gay couple got married, two women. One of them died and the other was forced to pay a large estate tax bill that she wouldn't have had to pay if her spouse had been a man. So that's actually very good news that they decided to take up two cases, because one will rule on the legality of gay marriage itself. The other will rule on the legality of the Defense of Marriage, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
Actually, it's only ruling on a part of the Defense of Marriage Act, but it's ruling on the part that specifically denies federal marriage benefits to same-sex couples.
Yeah, and that will take a lot of the teeth out of DOMA, I think. They will be probably hearing arguments on these two cases in March and rule sometime in the summer. So it won't be a quick thing, but this year there will be some good news, I'm hoping, on gay marriage. And it's got, you know, it's one of those things where Justice Anthony Kennedy, who usually votes for the conservatives, may vote this time for the liberals, because he's very much for personal individual rights.
He's authored the opinions on a couple of favorable gay rights landmark cases in the past in the Supreme Court.
All right. Moving on, the Obama administration looking at increasing spying.
Yeah, Washington Post report this week that the Obama administration is vastly going to increase the spying capacity of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, sending hundreds of new spies overseas as part of a plan to make the DIA equal in size to the CIA. Now, you may ask yourself, why does the United States need a second new enormous intelligence agency? Well, for starters,
because the DIA is not new, but it's never been as big as the CIA.
Yes. Well, for starters, because the CIA's mission in recent years has radically changed to where it is now primarily doing military-type field work. The second reason, of course, is it's a power play by the Pentagon. And, in fact, the spying capacity of the DIA was really pretty negligible until the Bush administration, when Dick Cheney used it as a counter to what he saw as hostile elements in the CIA, who kept insisting on the reporting on the facts rather than, for example, the nuclear program of Saddam Hussein and his links to al-Qaeda,
which
did not exist, but he managed to get some people in the DIA to claim that it didn't exist, and then stovepiped that intelligence to the executive branch over the CIA intelligence that did not exist. Now, the other the reason he could do that, and the reason that DIA expansion, just other than general principle, is so worrisome, is there's no congressional oversight for the DIA's work. The CIA has to report to the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, and there is some oversight there for the executive branch. There is none for the DIA. And the overall expansion yet again of the national security state and the national surveillance state should be very, very, and also the DIA, unlike the CIA, is not prohibited by charter from spying within the United States borders.
Although on that Americans
hasn't really stopped the CIA, but the DIA can do it legally and overtly. Very, very worrisome that yet again these apparatus are being expanded without really any public debate.
All right. And tied to that, New York Times had coverage this week about targeting of dissidents.
Yeah, on Tuesday, the New York Times had an article on the government targeting of United States citizens who object to American policy, or those who have believed to be engaging in dissent. They had several examples of people who were subject to repeated and extremely invasive border searches, including seizing and sometimes keeping for months their laptops and other electronic data. One example they gave, Laura Poitras, who's a documentary filmmaker and a MacArthur Fellowship recipient this year, estimated that she'd been detained more than 40 times upon returning to the United States, questioned for hours about her meeting abroad. Her credit cards and notes have been copied, and after one trip, her laptop, camera, and cell phone were all seized for nearly 2 months. The interrogations, incidentally, largely subsided after a Salon article that described her experiences, but she's editing her latest film in Europe in order to avoid having to cross the border with her research and interviews.
And that's just that, harassment.
That's just harassment, and they had several other similar examples, all of people who've never even been suspected of, let alone charged with, doing anything illegal. It's just that they're trying to bring unsavory practices in the United States government to light. And if this is happening to people who have relatively high profiles, such as a filmmaker and some of the other examples they had, just imagine how ordinary citizens who engage in dissent are being treated.
And where was that article again?
That was Tuesday in the New York Times.
Okay.
All right. Moving on, the Republicans not voting in favor for people with disabilities this week.
Yeah, the Senate Republicans, 38 of them blocked because they requires a two-thirds majority to ratify treaties, blocked the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, that is to say, blocked the United States signing on to that, even though that particular convention is almost explicitly modeled on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Act, so it's already law in the United States. But because it's the United Nations, a number of these Tea Party Republicans voted against it, you know, because of Agenda 21 and black helicopters and you know, they're taking us over with their creeping European socialism. There was one priceless quote by a pundit in a TV station in Chicago saying that if you thought the Republican Party only tries to appeal to well-off, married, white, suburban, and rural Christian men, boy, are you wrong. The Republican Party tries to appeal only to well-off, white, suburban, and rural, able-bodied Christian men. And that's about what it boils down to. Again, very, very worrisome. It appears as something as slam dunk as that cannot pass. At this point, the United States Senate cannot bring itself to ratify any treaty with the words United Nations in it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's jump to international. If we got time, we can jump back. Start with Israel and Palestine developments there.
Yeah, we talked last week about the United Nations General Assembly voting to essentially recognize as a legitimate nation state the nation of Palestine. Israel, in retaliation for this, in explicit retaliation for this, expanded its West Bank and East Jerusalem settlements, which of course are illegal under both international and domestic law in Israel. Really a provocation and an FU to the United Nations on that front. And of course, the United States did not particularly object to this. The United States being one of only, I believe, nine states that voted against recognition of Palestine last week. Well, the United Nations General Assembly came back this week with another vote, overwhelmingly approved a resolution calling on Israel to sign the nuclear proliferation treaty and open its nuclear program to international expansion. That vote was 174-6 with six abstentions. The six voting
international
against
inspections, right?
International, yeah. Inspections. The same opponents who objected to Palestine being recognized were the ones who voted against Israel having to account to the world for its nuclear program. The United States, Israel, Canada, and three Pacific states whose foreign policy is largely controlled by the United States were the ones who voted against. And every other country in the world recognized that Israel is running an illegal nuclear program.
All right. The Philippines.
Yeah, well, this week the Philippines was hammered by Typhoon Bofa. It hit Mindanao first and then again in the north. It is the biggest Category 5 tropical storm to ever strike so close to the equator, most in the Pacific as in the Atlantic, strike farther north, with some 500 dead, 400 missing, and 300,000 or more people homeless. And that number is rising even as we speak, as people get to some of the more remote areas that it hit. So it is yet again an unprecedented storm of the century kind of situation. So far in 2012, that list includes...
Yeah, how many have we had this year?
So far in 2012, that list includes wildfires in Chile, heat waves and severe drought in most of the U.S., wildfires in the western U.S., extreme snowstorms in Europe, Asia, Japan, and Alaska, damaging thunderstorms in the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic, floods and landslides in Brazil, more severe storms and flooding in Australia, extreme droughts in Africa, the warmest winter on record in the continental U.S., along with the coldest, or one of the coldest on record in Europe, record sea ice loss in the Arctic, record ice melting in the Greenland, and this past week, 2 feet of snow in Stevens Pass in one day. Yeah. So I think there's a reasonable conclusion that can be drawn by this, that that global warming is happening and climate change is happening. And as we've seen with any number of metrics, not only is happening, but it is accelerating at a far, far faster rate than even the worst case scenarios have extrapolated. So this is the new normal, and it's going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. All right. Global corruption.
Yeah, Transparency International released their Global Corruption Index this week. Where did we rank on it? Well, the United States was the 19th cleanest nation in the world. Of course, we could do a lot better. Most European nations were ahead of us on the list. But I was interested in the other end of the list, the most corrupt. The most corrupt nation in the world on the list was Somalia, which has no government to speak of. Second most corrupt was North Korea, which has no transparency to speak of. And third corrupt was someone that may sound very familiar to all our listeners, our good friend and a government that the United States helped put into power, Afghanistan. Our other good friend in the Middle East that we also helped put into power, Iraq, was number 8 on the most corrupt list. And after looking at this, I just kind of scratched my head and I said, okay, now, you know, the Republicans are pushing the whole deficit reduction thing in Congress, saying that if we don't reduce the U.S. deficit, we're going to end up like Greece. And from my experience and from my reading, I know that one of the reasons why Greece has got so many problems and why investors are driving up their interest rate on their government debt and why they're on the verge of bankruptcy is that Greece has a big corruption problem. So I asked myself, okay, if the U.S. is going the way of Greece, we should be somewhere on the list around the same rank as Greece, right? So we're at number 19. Greece, however, is 94th most corrupt out of 176 nations, or the 82nd most cleanest on the list, whereas we're at number 19. So I think we ought to, like, take this list and wave it in front of the Republicans in Congress and say, dudes, we're not anywhere near where Greece is. Can you get over the whole deficit? The whole deficit thing that you're so damn worried about.
Well, except that those were the people who were intending to bring democracy to Afghanistan and in Iraq. So this is actually their conception of democracy. And I suspect the U.S. would be a lot lower on the list of cleanest governments.
If the Republicans got their way.
Well, not just that. We know that. But also if illegal campaign contributions to elected officials were considered illegal.
Yeah.
All right. And final item, backing up a step, the report on CEOs this week.
Yeah, Forbes had an interesting report this week on the measurement of brand perception in the marketplace, which is kind of a standard measure for companies trying to figure out how their brands are playing out and whether people think favorably of their companies, particularly not just investors but also people who buy their retail products. And looking at how companies have reformed whose CEOs came out publicly against Obamacare before the latest election. The CEO of Papa John's, for example, promising that he would be firing workers and giving out a lot more part-time and temp jobs in order to avoid Obamacare because he couldn't afford it. And there were several other CEOs who did similarly. Well, Papa John's went from 32, which is reasonably good, to 4, which is abysmal, on the brand perception index, and Applebee's, which is a similar situation, went from 35 to 5. Darden Restaurants, which owns Olive Garden and Red Lobster, lowered its profit estimates for the quarter as a result of the publicity around its CEO's statements. And Denny's also running into problems with that. So I think there's a fairly clear message there from American consumers of some of these restaurants. And mind you, these are restaurants that the rich do not eat at. These are restaurants that are eaten at by the middle and lower middle classes.
People who need health care.
Yeah. Yes, people who need health care, and particularly if the products of these restaurants are a regular part of their diet, they will be needing health care. They're basically telling these CEOs to, eat it.
All right. Events.
Several of them going on. Today at 2 o'clock, there's a memorial service for Emily Horswell, who died at age 91 last month. She was an environmental journalist and very well-known activist in the region. That will be at Plymouth Congregational Church, 1217 6th Avenue in downtown Seattle. Monday, December 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m., U.S. Military Violence Against Women, What Can We Do? It's a film and talk by Michiko Hase, a member of the International Women's Network Against Militarism. That'll be at the Southside Commons, 3518 South Edmund Street in beautiful Columbia City. Wednesday, December 12th from 7:30 to 9 a.m., Equal Rights Washington will be doing a toasting equality breakfast. That's their big fundraiser for the year. $60 online for registration for that breakfast until Monday night, and this coming Monday night, and then $75 at the door. That'll be at the Grand Ballroom 3 of the Westin Hotels, 1900 5th Avenue in downtown Seattle. A lot of folks celebrating gay marriage. Then Thursday from 4 to 7 o'clock, actually the doors open for the hearing at 3:30, the last of around the state of the public hearings on coal trains. And coal trains, particularly in Washington State, mile-long trains going along the waterfront on their way to the coal port and shipping terminal in Bellingham. That is going to be a big deal. The ballroom holds 3,500, and they're expecting an overflow crowd for that. 3:30, the doors open for that. Next Thursday, 4 o'clock will be the start of a rally at the adjacent Freeway Hall. The doors open at the Washington Trade and Convention Center in downtown Seattle. On Thursday evening, also, Adrienne Grieve and a panel on flooding, storm surges, and what's next, our regional response to a warming climate. That'll be $5 at Town Hall, just up the street at 8th and Seneca. And then on Friday evening, December 14th at 1 o'clock, there'll be a solidarity rally for Maddie Pfeiffer. She's an Olympia activist who will likely be the next person to be jailed for contempt for refusing to testify to that now notorious secret federal grand jury poking around in the lives of local activists. That'll be at the federal courthouse at 700 Stewart Street in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find my work at mariatomchick.com.